welcome to another Inside Story podcast. This time, a strange federal election and the news media that brings us the myriad stories about power and politics. I'm Peter Clark in Melbourne. And with us today to discuss the recent, deeply unusual federal election and the role of the news media before, during and after that election, Brian Costar, Professor of Victorian State Parliamentary Democracy at Swinburne University, and, I must say, a long-time media analyst and commentator on political affairs, both local and national. And on the phone with us at Inside Story, Sophie Black, editor of the pioneering and very successful online news and current affairs service, Crikey.com. Brian, Sophie, good to have you with us at Inside Story.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Brian, let's get into our little magical helicopter to start with, just to give us a feel for where we're at. This is only a few days, really, after the swearing-in of the new Gillard ministry. As we gather around this table, I use the term unusual. We're hearing all sorts of terminology, aren't we, like new paradigms, old paradigms, a lot of sort of idealistic stuff coming from people like Rob Oakeshott, one of the independents who actually handed power to Julia Gillard in company with others. Taking that broad historical view, just how different is this time politically in Australia?
Well, I think in a structural sense it's quite different because we haven't had a minority federal government in Australia since just prior to the 1943 election, so that shows how long ago it was. I don't think we're going to see any new paradigms. I think that was rhetoric of the day when the independents signed up with the Gillard government. I mean, if you look at the opposition, there's nothing new about their paradigm. In fact, I've rarely seen an opposition so belligerent. Now, it will be very interesting what happens when we get to the floor of the Parliament because, yes, I mean, all oppositions, particularly ones with such a large minority, can, if they choose, can be very, if you like, confronting on the floor of the Parliament. And, of course, they still have a blocking majority in the Senate. Of course, what the opposition has to be a bit careful about is that they don't have a majority, that if they are difficult in the Parliament, then perhaps the independents will line up with Labor in order to exact some retribution. I mean, I don't think this talk about it's all going to be soft and cuddly, I can't believe that. I mean, the House of Representatives have never been like that, and I can't see why it's like it now, particularly since the Coalition have a bad case of the bad losers. I mean, they are very upset about not winning, so why should they be cooperative?
They don't seem to have learnt very much, and I know you've written about this, about what happened with the BRACS minority government going back a good decade plus, when in fact Jeff Kennett, the then Premier, didn't seem to learn how to be nice to independents or to interact with them very well. Did we see the same pattern re-emerge with the Coalition?
As much as we could see in the public arena, I think that was partially true. When it came, the situation in Victoria in 1999, where the Kennett government had more seats in the Parliament than Labor, but three independents made the difference. Kennett didn't negotiate terribly well with them at all. He sort of made demands on them and tried to interfere at almost every point to get them to see his view, which, of course, turned out to be not very productive because you formed a Labor government. The other thing that was interesting about that, of course, is that that Labor government persisted. It didn't collapse. Ran its almost its full term. And the history of, while we haven't seen minority governments at the federal level in Australia for a very long time, they've been quite common at state and territory levels. And save for the ones in Tasmania in the late 1980s and early 90s, which were the first, if you like, of the modern minority governments, all of those governments have been quite stable. They've generally run their full term. And they haven't really policy gridlocked. I think the real problem that the Gillard government has, other than avoiding by-elections, is the fact that they've got to get through until the 1st of July next year, because at that point the Senate numbers become much more favourable to the Gillard government, and then they'll be able to actually implement some programs. I think one of the problems with the Rudd and Gillard governments running up to the election was that they simply didn't take notice of the fact that they didn't have a working majority in the Senate, and contentious legislation could be blocked, and it was blocked. And from what we hear from the defeated Senator Fielding, he's going to oppose everything, even talking about blocking supply. He's going to be a lonely vote on that issue. But I think that what Labor should do is govern, but not bring forth too much, if you like, contentious legislation, because if it gets defeated, as it will in the Senate, I mean, people out in the street will take that to mean the government's not doing anything. There's no need for them to be knowledgeable about the arcane workings of the Senate. What they're saying is, let's say Labor puts up their broadband legislation and it gets beaten, then people might interpret Labor's not doing anything. I think they would be better off to keep their powder dry until the 1st of July next year, have all the legislation well prepared, a lot better prepared than some of it was under the Rudd regime, and then bring it forth at that time.
Sophie, I'd be interested to hear what your non-political science view of all this is. We've just lived through a quite extraordinary election, and that weird period after the election while the independents made their decisions. How did you see all that, and how did you see the actual media coverage of that?
It's been fascinating to watch the media try to wrap their heads around this new political environment, us included, really. We actually wrote an editorial the other day saying, entitled Weaning Off the Crack, referring to a reader who had admonished us for reporting, being addicted to the crack cocaine of conflict in politics and reporting the contest as if there are still two teams battling it out, which isn't necessarily the reality now. But as Brian says, in the next 6 months, fundamentally that really still will be the reality in terms of getting legislation through the Senate. And we see Tony Abbott today vowing to sort of sick Malcolm Turnbull, his new communications minister, onto the NBN and in fact demolish the NBN. So that sort of conflict certainly hasn't left the coalition's rhetoric in any way. But the media does need to sort of pull back and think about how they report these stories. And there's been a lot of navel-gazing. It was an extraordinary election campaign in that it was so fundamentally dull and the public were incredibly disengaged. And for the first time, really, we had a 24/7 media cycle. We had social networking like Twitter all over the election. We had all of these different platforms covering the campaign, including the new 24-hour channel coming out from ABC, the ABC. But there wasn't a whole lot to report on. There weren't the big ticket items that we saw back in 2007. There weren't the big ideas. And so you were faced with a public that were very disengaged. And as a result, we've come out with this extraordinary sort of political setup. So in the process, I mean, looking back on even the first sort of press club luncheon with the independents when they first collectively faced the press gallery, and this was before a minority government was formed, it was interesting to see people like Robert Oakeshott ticking off certain members of the gallery for the way they framed their questions in terms of this language of conflict and who's winning and who's losing. And he mentions the P word a lot, paradigm, and I think we're tiring of that already. But he does have a point in that there are a lot more political players on the scene now, and let's not forget the Greens Party in this. So reporting does require a little bit more nuance than a sensational headline can provide.
That hunger of the press pack was reflected very strongly, wasn't it, during the live broadcast and streaming of the two independents declaring where they were going to go with the government. The great impatience because of the apparently 17-minute introduction by Oakeshott before he finally said what he was there to say in terms of the media outcome. But I'm just wondering if that's really a symptom, isn't it, that you're just hungry for the, is it this or is it that, that binary sort of thinking, whereas people like Oakeshott and others are now pointing to a much more nuanced sort of political dynamic.
Absolutely, and look, it was torturous. I think it was the culmination of a 17-day wait after a very long 5-week campaign and a very unsettled political environment ever since Gillard grabbed the mantle from Kevin Rudd. So it all boiled down to this 17 minutes in which the nation, or the press gallery at the very least, were holding their breath, waiting for Oakeshott to come out with it. But Look, Oakeshott's not naive. He knew, as soon as he said who he was going for, the press pack would run off to file their stories, and they wouldn't... Well, his argument is that they wouldn't necessarily take in all the finer detail of why he made his decision, and he needed to make that very clear, and he was very eager to lay out those points and insert a quote from Highlander into the process.
That's right. And do you think, in many ways, during that very tense period leading up to the announcement, those couple of weeks, do you think the media actually dropped the ball? There seemed to be no ready narrative, number one, and there seemed to be an absence of real, I guess you could call it speculative analysis of those independents, what the policy dynamics might be, what the tensions might be. There were plenty of really top-flight journalists around the place who could have really dug deep on some of that, but we didn't get much of that, did we?
No, we didn't. And look, the media are very good at talking about themselves, but the amount of navel-gazing that's come out of this campaign and soul-searching on the part of journalists, editors and publishers has been pretty extraordinary. And some very hard questions have been asked, including during the campaign. There was there's a blogger called Grogs Gamut, and he had a go on Twitter at various members of the press pack for the lack of substance and the lack of policy questions that they were putting to the candidates during various press conferences. That stirred up a lot of debate and conversation on Twitter that then flowed into both, you know, the ABC website. It was on Crikey, it was in the National Broadsheet, the Australian addressed it. A lot of conversation amongst journalists about whether they were doing their job properly, and if they weren't, why weren't they doing the job properly. In their defence, a few journalists said part of it has to do with the way information is dispensed by the two political parties, and that very often on the campaign trail, press releases and policy detail isn't released to the journalists until, you know, 10 minutes before the press conference, because there are various motivating factors there, but that's, journalists were saying, you know, we're really not afforded the information that we need to ask the right questions.
They've been saying that for many, many years. I remember speaking about this on the radio, you know, a few elections back. Get off the bus, guys, get off the magical mystery tour and actually play that hardball game and say, okay, well, we won't do the press conference if you don't give us the information in due time. I mean, is it fairly supine of the media to be running that line these days?
Look, I think so. I think there was also an even more heightened emphasis on polls. I think, and in all the frenzy of number crunching on, you know, who was leading and who was preferred leader, I think the fact that we were looking at a hung parliament got lost in the mix. I mean, there was a bit of speculation about it, and the independents did feature in a few different interviews. We interviewed each independent before we went to the polls, but really, I think there was a bit of scepticism as to just how close this was. There was a theory that you know, the public were so disengaged that you know, that surely they would vote the incumbent government back in. There are all these theories going around, but you know, the idea of a hung parliament wasn't explored to the fullest extent, I don't think. And neither were, you know, the leaders tested on some of the assumptions they were making and some of their sound bites, such as, you know, their policy on asylum seekers, the issue of population, and for that fact, I think that the media are still sort of hashing over what went wrong in a lot of ways and where to from here. There's still some very, very interesting discussion going on around how to report on this new political dynamic, and also where the Greens fit in. And I think at the moment there's a lot of conversation going on around the Australian and their reporting of such issues.
Indeed, and I want to come to some of that more sharply in a moment. Brian, a very similar question to you, I suppose, for someone who for a long time has been concerned about the role of what we used to call the Fourth Estate, and what we call it these days, but democracy is the key word here. How did you see this last period and the role of the media?
I don't think they've covered themselves in glory at all. I think the problem was, during the election campaign, that it really was a campaign about almost nothing. I think the result reflected the quality of the campaign. The people didn't want either of them. I mean, they voted it for a tie. I mean, it was extraordinary. I think certainly the media got wrong-footed very badly in terms of the hung parliament and minority government and what that might mean and how that would play out. I think, I will single out one of the broadsheets, and that's The Australian. I think it's in a sense crossed the line now almost into the British notion of having partisan newspapers. I think that some of the headlining, for a long time now, its opinion page has sort of been the newsletter of a number of neoliberal think tanks and not much else. I think they're barracking rather than reporting and analysing. Now, there are two journalists on that paper for whom you'd make that an exception, but I thought the quality was poor. I thought on a technical issue, when the question of the hung parliament showed up, even amongst some of the quite senior journalists, was a lack of understanding just of the role of the Governor-General. I mean, we were told some extraordinary things about how the Governor-General was going to be proactive and she was going to call another election and she was going to do this and she was going to do that, where, you know, the first-year political science student would be burnt alive for saying
And that's been out in the public arena in many different contexts, including the Republican debate, when we really parsed in fine detail the powers of the Governor-General, yet here we are with all that rubbish going round.
Yes, we seem to forget these things. Also, one thing that post-election that I think needs to be put into perspective, and I haven't seen much analysis of this, and that is, why was Queensland so significant in this election? If you look at the rest of the states, in terms of seat losses, the seat losses to the government were modest indeed. In fact, in Victoria, there were seat gains.
Yes.
In some states, there were no seat losses. And in Tasmania, the loss was to a Labor-leaning independent. But in Queensland, the Labor Party was simply collapsed. Now, why has that happened, and why haven't we seen a bit of detailed analysis about that? Now, I think the real test is going to come for all sorts of political players, not just the media, is when we move to the real stage, that is, when the new Senate takes its place, because then you've got a minority government, but you've also got that minority government having a very strong Labor-Green vote in the Senate. I mean, the Labor and the Greens will have, about 40, I think, at the moment, senators. That's a very clear majority in the Senate. Now, of course, the Greens are not going to vote with Labor on everything. We know that.
And they might even go in a different direction. This is the very interesting aspect of all this, on something like paid parental leave.
Mm. Oh, yes, they could do all sorts of things. Now, this is another thing why I find it rather strange why the opposition has been so
rude.
Hysterically rude towards both the independents who went with Labor and the Greens.
They might need them one day.
They might need these people. I mean, they seem to... This is the... Can I just hark back here how people can get fevered about this? The big mistake that Jeff Kennett made in 1999 is he assumed that there was no chance that the three independents were going to go with the coalition. That was untrue. It was known around the traps at the time, and it subsequently became public, because the big issue for the independents in Victoria was reform of the upper house.
Yes.
Now, Kennett, that was the one issue he wouldn't agree to, yet if he had agreed to it, the independents would have had to have supported him, because he was the only party that had a majority with them in the lower house and in their own right in the Legislative Council who could have legislated that reform. If he had said, yes, we will take on board reforming the upper house, he would have been the Premier.
And also, Brian, I think a few people have made reference to the fact that the coalition didn't necessarily have the stomach for minority government. I think there's no doubting that Tony Abbott was genuine in wanting it, but there has been talk around the traps that others were not so keen. And I think, you know, we're all having a go at the media for not changing their language around the reportage of these new events. But the coalition certainly haven't changed their strategy. And the Greens, you know, people may be cynical about this, but the Greens and the independents have both said, look, there's nothing stopping the coalition from putting legislation forward. We are willing to work with them. And given that the public have shown that they are very dissatisfied with how the parties have distorted the political process, You would think that the Abbott government would be keen to show that they can work with different, the different parties.
Yes, but Sophie and Brian, that raises the spectre for me of, say we did go down that path where the Greens work with the coalition opposition and reforged a key piece of legislation which the government, in the face of the numbers, actually had to surrender to, finally putting the best possible spin on it. That's a different way, that's a different sort of political culture for Australia, Sophie, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think it may be too great a leap for the coalition, just going on the way that they're already framing the government. And as you say, they came out, they were extraordinarily bitter in the sort of the days after minority government was formed. Some going as far as to say that the government was illegitimate.
They're still saying it.
They're still saying it. They're still saying, you know, that there's no mandate. They're illegitimate. So, you know, you have to wonder whether the strategy is to blow everything up in front of them and make the government look as dysfunctional as possible, make this arrangement look dysfunctional with the hope of going to the polls early. That seems to be the strategy so far.
Yes, I think the coalition's running an all-or-nothing strategy on two levels. One is they're assuming that this government will not last.
Mm.
Now, the only way it's not going to last is if there are by-elections which the government loses. Now, I just, I can't help it, being a political scientist, there have been 42 by-elections for the House of Representatives since 1980, only three of which were caused by the death of the sitting member. So just on the stats of this, I even saw some newspapers were running around quoting professors of actuarial science, which I thought was arrant nonsense. We'll set that aside. The other thing, and of course that could happen, there could be by-elections, but people are saying it's one by-election. I don't think that Mr. Katter would necessarily vote for a vote of no confidence in the Labor government if that risked an election.
Mm.
Now, it's certainly true that the coalition want an election. Well, why not? There's nothing to lose. I mean, they think they can't do any worse. And who knows about that? But I think on the parliamentary issue, the opposition is running, again, an all-or-nothing strategy, which I think is silly.
Mm.
Their attitude seems to be is that there's a piece of legislation, we oppose it, so therefore it doesn't pass.
Mm.
We support it, it does pass. Don't we move amendments in parliaments anymore?
Mm.
I mean, on the floor of the House of Representatives at the moment, who's to say that Windsor and Oakeshott would not be sympathetic to opposition amendments? They haven't locked themselves in to supporting every piece of government legislation that comes before the House.
Or, heaven forbid, actually try and forge an optimal piece of legislation.
Yes.
And interestingly enough, that the coalition in many ways, some have suggested, lost the election in the days in which, you know, those 17 days in which they needed to focus on negotiating with the independents and showing that they were willing to really, you know, to talk seriously and to think seriously about these different policies, not only to do with the costings and this hole that everybody keeps referring to, but just in the way that Abbott initially seemed quite combative towards the independents, initially didn't want to reveal his costings to them, compared to Gillard's approach, which was, I'm willing to talk on anything, and I'm willing to put forward anyone you need to talk to about absolutely anything. And the most recent polling on whether or not the independents did the right thing suggests that the public think that they should have gone for a minority Labor government.
Referring back to something Sophie said earlier, Brian, about not testing statements, we see that happening in spades, don't we, all the time. But there's a key word that when I was doing political science at our alma mater, the University of Queensland, the word mandate had a very particular meaning. It has an historical meaning, it has a technical meaning, but I notice everyone's chucking the word mandate around now. Apparently Tony Abbott has a mandate to ferociously oppose, and the government has a mandate to do this, and someone else has it, the Greens have a mandate to do that. Once upon a time we may have had a political reporter who really knew what they were on about and were well educated in that area. We seem to have lost that to some degree.
Yes, we do. I think one of the things about mandate, of course, is that mandates became a very old-fashioned concept, because when that notion was crafted, there was the expectation that the big political parties would go to elections with a manifesto. I mean, we can excuse journalists for not questioning them about policy manifestos, because they don't have policy manifestos anymore. They have sound bites replacing policy. We've been a bit critical here of the opposition in their behaviour. I think they deserve it. I think one criticism that I think needs to be laid at the government, and we've seen it just recently, they need to lift their level of competency. I know it sounds a very vague and old-fashioned term, but they were not particularly competent. I mean, look at this. Okay, it's minor stuff, messing up the names of the ministers.
Well, it wasn't that minor, really, was it? In the education area.
I suppose not.
Add-ons as you go to the GG swearing in.
What are officials doing?
And in an environment where they have to assure the public that they can make this work, any minor glitch that dominates a headline, which these glitches have dominated over the last 2 days, is not great for public confidence.
No, yes. I think they've got to get back. I mean, here we're going, we're showing my age here. Can we please have a bit of old-fashioned cabinet government? Not gangs of four. Robust discussion in cabinet, good cabinet submissions, an argument around a table that comes out with what Peter just called an optimum policy.
And it's interesting, isn't it, that I think, I haven't seen all the matchups that have just come out from the coalition, but I think they are using the word education in their opposition shadow spokespeople. So the very titles become a bit of a game as well, and you can gain advantage by having the word education in the opposition spokesperson's title compared to tertiary education or even just skills in the actual ministry. So you're right about the officials, I think, that no one went out the back and actually worked out how to actually title all these ministries.
Well, the question here, of course, and we like to get inside the black box on this, is who's calling the shots? I'm talking about let's have a bit of a return to cabinet government. That involves officials. That means civil servants. That doesn't mean kids in ministerial offices.
Absolutely, and transparency is essential because, in the public's mind, they're asking that very question, Brian. They're thinking, who's in whose ear and why are they changing it? Why didn't they do that in the first place? And, where are the Greens and what are they whispering and what are the independents whispering? And when really, I think it does come down to incompetence. That's all it is. But again, it's not a good look in these very early days of a minority government.
Let's leave the politicians aside for just one moment with their hubris and incompetence and talk about what's really under the spotlight too at the moment from the political class and the media class about, I guess, leading journalists who want to be players in the political process. We saw the really amazing example of Laurie Oakes during the election campaign itself with his leaks, but Kerry O'Brien's probably in that class, many of the Australian journalists in that class. They don't necessarily see themselves anymore as simply reporting or analysing and perhaps some opinion, but actually being players. Do you see it that way, Sophie, and is it dangerous?
I think yes, I think there's much more of a sense of these people as personalities in their own right. I think part of that has to do with the fact that they're featuring on social platforms like Twitter.
Yes.
It's very easy these days to access their thinking on issues. They're constantly tweeting about what stories they're working on, theories they have on breaking news. It's much easier to get a sense of their personalities than it used to be. I don't think that necessarily has to be a bad thing. And I think Jay Rosen, who was recently in the country, he discussed the fact that in this sort of new media environment, transparency is the new objectivity. So it's not necessarily about being hiding behind, the anonymity of a masthead these days. It's more about adequately explaining your thinking on issues and adequately explaining why you think that way and your background on things and disclosure, I think.
Yes, and with Twitter and all the other social media, what many academics call ambient journalism, that it's become much more three-dimensional now, hasn't it, and much more complex in terms of the interflow of opinion and news and reporting and even a breakdown between competing journalists for different outlets now. I noticed, particularly during the Liberal leadership change, I was following that on Twitter, and there are all sorts of people breaking little bits of the story across competing outlets, which was fascinating.
Absolutely, and you can see them engaging with each other as well. So in one way, as a reader, you can get a much better sense of how the process works and how the information flows. I think that can only be a good thing, but I think it's when egos and personalities get confused with that and people make themselves the story, that's when it gets a little dangerous.
Now, you mentioned Jay Rosen. I want to bounce this off both of you. You've probably both read some of this, that Jay Rosen was, in fact, out here. He was rather almost sneeringly disapproving of what he labelled, and we used the term ourselves, I guess, over the years, the horse race approach, you know, who's winning at any given moment. He talks about an approach which is not brand new. It springs out of a movement in the late 80s, early 90s, the citizen's agenda in campaign coverage. He's written extensively about that, Brian. The idea that it's the responsibility of the media to get out well before an election and create a very substantial agenda that is derived not from other journalists, not from the politicians, certainly, but from the citizenry, and make that the real touchstone of the election coverage. Don't necessarily get on the bus and cop a press release 2 seconds before a press conference. Actually have a great body of sort of ordered issues that the citizenry have helped you create. What do you think of that? Is that even feasible or possible in these days of the 24/7 news cycle?
At the risk of being difficult, I think it's dangerously naive. I remember that movement going on. In fact, it got an influence in Australia for a while that the media were not going to report. If, for example, they were not going to run so-called horse race polls during elections. Well, what are they going to run then? I find that thing, it sounds very nice, yes, let's build it out from the citizenry. I'm a long-time critic of deliberative democracy because I think it's dangerous in the sense that what if the people don't want to participate? We've got to make a distinction here between an informed electorate. I think I have the deepest regard for the good sense of the Australian electorate. They didn't vote for Mark Latham, for example. The Australian electorate as a collective rarely get the result wrong. They didn't get a result this time because that was what was deserved. But on the other hand, ordinary people are not like the political class. The political class are obsessed with politics. They're obsessed with what I'd call the immediacy and the urgency of politics. People are not like that. People are living their lives. Politics comes in at a time, it comes out. They're not thinking about this all the time. I think all this deliberative democracy and citizen agendas can easily be hijacked by very unrepresentative interest groups because how do you engage the citizenry unless you give them a vote? And we give them votes. I'm not impressed with all that at all. What I'm less impressed with, though, and I think what a lot of this is, it's the intrusion of celebrity right through an area of politics where it has no place. Mm. Now, I'm not talking here about leadership. I mean, yes, political parties have always had leaders. Countries have leaders. There's nothing new about that. But we're getting now to the leader who has nothing to lead about. It's the Paris Hilton syndrome. I mean, if you think seriously, I mean, what is Paris Hilton?
Do you put Gillard in that category?
No. I think Gillard has got more depth to her, but they've got it. But she has got to assert her depth, which may well mean...
But when she knocked over Rudd, it did seem initially very much about just her as the personality, didn't it?
Well, I mean, how much was that and how much was that framed by the novelty of the first woman Prime Minister?
Mm.
You can never judge that. But there is no doubt that Gillard has got some depth to her. But the trouble is, I mean, these people are managed by their advisers. I mean, I think one of the worst things that's happened in Australian politics, and it was a Whitlam initiative, we can hardly blame him, I suppose, was the proliferation of ministerial and office advisers who really are coming. I mean, in one sense, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, if you had policy people there as liaisons back into your public service department, there is nothing wrong with that, and that was initially what it was about. But what happens now is that these people come from a very narrow background, from both sides of politics, and all they're interested in is the 24/7 news cycle. They're interested in little wins.
Gillard has now said that it will no longer be about the soundbite on the 6 p.m. news, referring sort of not very subtly to the fact that with Rudd it was very much about that. But I think you're right, Brian. I think in terms of advisers, there is more depth to Gillard than that, but it certainly wasn't apparent in the first few weeks of the election. And we scoff at Gillard's announcement that the real Julia was now going to come out halfway through the campaign. But she did have a point there. There was so much... She'd been so overmanaged that she was lost in the process. And the public, you're right, the public aren't stupid. The public saw right through that.
Sophie and Brian, I'm very interested in the phenomenon of Anthony Green, the electoral analyst for the ABC, the national broadcaster. It seems to me that he was out and about so much and was used by so many, partly, in my opinion, because there were very few other really good neutral guides or explainers of what was going on. Do you see, Sophie, a real absence of that other sort of role, someone who's really there to fill out the detail, to explain? Jay Rosen's talking about this as well, the branded department of explainers that he suggested to the ABC, for example. Mm. And I guess I'm searching in this conversation as we come to an end for some sort of antidote to this idea of grown-up journalists, very intelligent people, being shackled by spinmeisters and media managers on the part of the political parties, particularly during elections when you put on a bus and fed you-know-what. So I'm looking for an antidote in that context. What do you think of the Anthony Green phenomenon? Is there a symptom there that he represents? And what is the antidote, in your opinion, for doing the next election better?
I think there was so much confusion over how close the election was set to be and then what would happen in the event of a hung parliament, that Anthony Green was sort of like the beacon of hope, that the one person that everybody turned to explain what the hell was going on. But I think there is a need for background on these sorts of things, for the media to step back occasionally and say, okay, let's connect the dots on this. Let's talk about the history of this policy, or where this soundbite's coming from and why. Crikey actually endeavours to do that. We have a thing called the Crikey Clarifier, which is sort of loosely based on the Slate have a similar thing called the Explainer.
Yes.
And it is this, it's a recognition of, with all the information that we're bombarded with these days and the nature of the news cycle and the frenetic pace, occasionally people who aren't engaged in that all day, every day, just want somebody to explain to them what the hell is going on. They need the background. They're not up with every single breaking news story. They just want to step back and read something that they from a source that they trust, that can explain to them the background, the conversation, and why the media are reporting it the way they are. And I think Green was sort of a symptom of that in some ways, the focus on Anthony Green. But I think that's what the media needs to learn coming out of this election campaign. Just because we have every different media platform at our disposal, and just because we can fill 24 hours with news, doesn't mean we have to be coming up with something new and something, whiz-bang, every hour, on the hour. It does pay to step back occasionally and provide really decent, in-depth, long-form analysis and journalism, and the public are still hungry for that kind of thing.
This whole conversation, as we come to an end now, has been predicated upon the idea that there's a very deep and complex intertwining of the modern media and the modern political process, Brian and Sophie. So I'm going to ask you both to chance your arm. We've talked about the challenges, we've talked about some of the deficits in performance during the election itself and over time. Whether we call it a new paradigm or an old paradigm, Brian, we do seem to be in slightly different parts of the woods at the moment. Chance your arm. I'm not asking you to predict whether it's going to be a three-year minority Labor government, but how do you think things are going to play out in that relationship between particularly the high-level political media and the news media and the political players? How do you see it playing out from today?
Well, I think I was encouraged by the Prime Minister's comments about not chasing the 24/7 news cycle.
Yes.
I, for example, don't feel deprived if I don't see the Prime Minister on the news every night. Yet there has come this notion that the politicians, particularly the senior politicians, have got to be out and about. I mean, getting up at ungodly hours of the morning to appear on morning television. I mean, I find that just bizarre. I mean, it's not that long ago in which Prime Ministers were, a bit withdrawn. I mean, in the sense, I don't mean withdrawn as personalities, but remember, governments are chosen to do one thing, to govern, to do two things, to govern well. They don't have to be out and about, as I said, like political Paris Hiltons, every hour of the day on every news channel. I mean, I don't think people, the citizens don't necessarily want that. And I think prime ministers and leaders of the opposition and ministers and shadow ministers would be better off in their offices doing their jobs.
And that process of being questioned and having to think on your feet and being under really narrow beam pressure at times in terms of the dynamic of who's winning and who's saying what, often policy gets formed in radio studios to some degree and, and distorts the policy forging process.
And good policy can get distorted if someone stumbles in a television interview over some trivial issue. What's going to be the headline the next day? The stumble, not the policy. I mean, it's a... Well, I mean, I think the problem is that the relationship between the media and the political class is now so symbiotic that, you know, it's naive to think you're going to break it. But, I mean, I think that there are areas in which it can be vastly improved.
Sophie, you have the final word.
I agree with Brian in that there has been this tendency from politicians to feel that they need to feed this insatiable media machine.
The hungry beast.
The hungry beast. And I think now more than ever, the public are incredibly aware of spin and empty sound bites. And if we can take nothing else from this election result, it's that the public are deeply dissatisfied with that and they are looking for someone to lead. So I think if the politicians can take something from that and actually focus on policy and making this thing work, we could see some very interesting results.
Well, it's certainly not boring. We're not in a boring period, that's for sure, even though the election was sort of boring and that long hiatus waiting for the result is we're all trained to expect. That might have been a bit dull, but it's certainly not boring now as we watch, wait for the next meeting of our federal parliament. Sophie Black, editor of Crikey, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Professor Brian Costar from Swinburne University, thanks for being with us today as well.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this Inside Story podcast. Check out the site for the archive of other podcasts with leading writers and analysts from Australia and around the world. I'm Peter Clark. Thanks for your company, and I'll talk to you again soon. Bye for now.